Chapter 9. My First Year in India. That first year I devoted much of my time to helping Dayamata in her mission in India. She had gone there to familiarize herself with the work in that country, to regularize it if necessary, and to help the Yogoda Satsanga Society members, YSS is the Indian affiliate of SRF, to know their new president. I accompanied her in most of her public appearances, where I was often asked to sing an Indian bhajan or two at the start. A bhajan isn't devotional song, to set a spiritual atmosphere. Dayamata herself was not accustomed to giving lectures, but she easily won people's hearts and made Master real for them by her simple presence. I ran numerous errands for her in Calcutta, sat in on many meetings, and did whatever I could to make her stay in India easier for her. For gradually, as time went on, things grew increasingly difficult. The problem was with the workers themselves. None of SRF's Indian representatives appeared to have any idea that Master's birth had brought an earth-revitalizing message. To them, SRFYSS was another ashram merely, in a nation rife with thousands of ashrams. His teachings, in their opinion, were true, but perhaps a little over-Americanized for Indian tastes. They considered us certainly too American to understand or even fully to appreciate the ancient ways of India. To bring us up to snuff, they treated us to many traditional worship ceremonies, pujas, yajnas, impossibly dull dissertations on the Bhagavad Gita, and Sanskrit readings followed by clumsy English translations of other shastras or scriptures. And then, of course, explanations of numerous local customs and the deep reasons for each. At first, we entered wholeheartedly into everything. We felt humble devotion as we prostrated ourselves, then meditated in various temples and places of pilgrimage. We visited Tarakeshwar and listened entranced to stories of miraculous healings that had taken place there. Dayamata herself experienced a healing the day of our visit. We visited the beautiful Jain temple in Calcutta. Daya and the others visited Benares. I was not with them this time. And the home of Lahiri Mohashai. Together we visited the home of Ram Prasad, the famous Kali devotee of the 18th century, composer of still popular devotional songs to the Divine Mother. We visited the Kali temple in Dakshineshwar, where the great master Sri Ramakrishna had lived, worshipped, and found God. We visited Belur Math, founded by Ramakrishna's disciples. We visited Sri Yukteswar's ashram site in Serampur and his seaside ashram in Puri. We visited Master's school at Ranchi, of course. The list of places we saw and of saints we visited is endless. To all of us, the time spent in these ways was deeply inspiring. Gradually, however, we also began to observe that in the midst of all the pujas, yajnas, and dissertations on the Gita, Master and his teachings were being given a back seat. Where was the emphasis among his own devotees on Kriya Yoga? Where the attempt to show his mission as special? Every effort, rather, seemed directed toward presenting it as being firmly rooted in a tradition too ancient ever to be challenged. As for his organization, our leaders there considered it a matter for gratitude, certainly, that SRF was able to support its Indian branch financially. Thus, the Indian representatives weren't obliged to devote themselves with excessive worry to raising money to support the work. What SRF's assistance also accomplished for them, however, was lull them to sleep as far as any zeal for the work was concerned. The Indian mentality is not much inspired in any case by organizations. The Ramakrishna Mission, established about a century ago by Swami Vivekananda, has convinced people by its work of founding schools that organizations can, in fact, do good work. But as far as inspiration went, this had to be sought from saints individually or within oneself in meditation. Diamata won people's hearts not nearly so much in her capacity as president, as by the fact that they saw in her a person with deep devotion to God and Guru. Her monastic title, when we first went to India, was Sister. Indians, however, found it more inspiring to think of her as Mother. Accordingly, after her return to America, she persuaded the board of directors, quite rightly, to approve a change in her title from Sister to Mata, or Mother. The longer we stayed in India, the more clearly we realized that we didn't really have an organized work there. Oh, true, our Indian office sent out printed lessons to students in various parts of the country, but not to very many students. Indeed, the student enrollment was negligible. As for any outreach on Daya's part, it slowly became apparent to us that she was being carefully hemmed in, as though to prevent her from having any major impact on matters there. With loving smiles, nods of appreciation for her saintly example, and numerous functions given in her honor, her efforts to change and re-energize the work were nevertheless given the soft pillow treatment, the vigorous punch that lands only to be gently absorbed, its impact neutralized by a feather stuffing of silent opposition. As our mounting displeasure began to be apparent to others, attempts were made to fix the blame for whatever wasn't right on other people, never on anyone present at the time, of course. We, Diamata especially, were subjected to endless hours of gossip and accusations. Unfortunately, many of those accusations appeared to be not without merit. The time actually came when certain officials in the work conspired to get us sent out of the country. I have since learned that it was one person, Swami Brahmananda, who was behind this particular move. The police arrived one day at the Baranagar ashram with a notice to the effect that if we didn't leave India within 10 days, we would be deported. We had by this time, fortunately, made a few influential friends who were able to get the order rescinded. Our first year in India, begun with so much joy and inspiration, became increasingly sad for us. "What will happen to the work here?" Daya wondered aloud in anguish one day, not long before her departure. Sister Revati, who was with us, raised her chin in an expression of staunch faith. "Master's here," she declared. "Master will protect it." "Master," I couldn't help retorting, "has been here for the past 40 years, and what has he done?" I knew there was no point in expecting him to act, except through the agency of willing disciples. God himself accomplishes his will in the world through human channels. He even sends his awakened sons on earth to redeem sleeping souls. The story of our first year in India is primarily Diamata's to relate, or ours to relate about her. The thread I have selected for the present account, however, is that of my own role in serving Master's work. My frequent trips to Calcutta on Daya's behalf, my support role during her many visits and pilgrimages, were, I hope, useful to her, but they add only minor twists to the thread I've selected for these pages. Subheading: Singing Bengali Songs. One aspect of my presence at Daya's public appearances did, I found, win me a measure of public attention also, namely, the devotional songs I was asked to sing. Much to my surprise, my notoriety began preceding me wherever we went. The first thing our hosts did when we arrived was bring out a harmonium and request me to sing. I was happy in this way to bring people a greater appreciation for what Master had accomplished in America. It offended me, however, if anyone gave me credit that was withheld from Master. This happened during a visit to the south of India. It was after a short stay in Madras, where we had a small center. I then proceeded on to a well-known ashram in the south. This was the first time an SRF representative had gone there, and I had announced my arrival well in advance, writing in my official capacity as director of the SRF Center Department. The advance notice made no impact. "Have you heard of Paramahansa Yogananda?" I inquired, as I was being led to the office to be registered as a guest. "Oh, yes," was the indifferent reply, "but there are so many nowadays." I was given a space in their most primitive guest house. My sleeping section was divided off from other sleepers by a simple sheet of canvas, open at the top and at the bottom. For myself, I didn't mind, but I couldn't help thinking this was no way to show appreciation to Paramahansa Yogananda for the work he did on India's behalf in the West. I was the first visitor from SRF to their ashram. I asked if I might receive a tour of their extensive property. No car, I was told, was available, and that was that. The following day, a Calcutta devotee arrived who had been working on some project for them. A car was immediately placed at his disposal for a tour of the property. This devotee happened to be a friend of mine. He asked me to join him. Of course, they had to consent. After the tour, which was provided gratis for him, they asked me to pay 10 rupees to cover my part of the tour. My Calcutta friend afterward exclaimed, "Why, haven't you heard of Swami Kriyananda? He's a wonderful singer. You must take this opportunity to hear him sing Bengali bhajans." Bengali was the most prevalent Indian language in that ashram. A gathering was convened. I sang a few songs. Later, at a scheduled satsang, a few people observed me seated in deep meditation and were well impressed. Quite unexpectedly, I found myself greeted on all sides with great warmth and affection. The receptionist, a man whose reception had been so casual the day before, invited me to meet their general secretary. This gentleman, I had been informed previously, was too busy to see me. He received me now, standing, as a hint to me, I felt, to keep my visit as brief as possible. This sudden recognition, given to me personally when no one had paid me any heed as a disciple of one of the great gurus of our times, was to me doubly offensive. Wordlessly, the next day I paid my bill and left by the first bus for Madras. Subheading: Resistance to Lectures in Bengal. Knowing that Master had planned for me to lecture in India, Dayamata urged me to set up lectures during the little time I had available. By the local Indians, however, I was generally discouraged, either overtly or by their patent lack of enthusiasm. I remember one of our Indian directors devoting an hour one late afternoon trying to assure me that I was quite untrained to speak before the spiritually sophisticated audiences of Bengal. Finally, a Bengali friend did arrange a lecture for me at the Mahabodhi Hall in Calcutta. The lecture was well attended and well received. No further doors opened for me as a speaker, however. Kriyananda wasn't, after all, what was happening that year. It was Dayamata's time, quite properly. Moreover, my own appearance was against me. I looked younger than my 32 years, and even 32 was too young to impress most of my listeners, who were far older than I. Age, to a degree not appreciated by most Americans, citizens as we are of a young culture, receives primary respect in the most ancient of all lands, India.